KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers, it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And stay tuned. Next, Jenka Soderberg will be interviewing Alex Gates, a student at PSU. And we'll go to that in just a moment. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the psychedelic roots rock of Moon Alice, performing Thursday, October 23rd with the Garcia Birthday Band at the Alhambra Theater. The Alhambra is located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne in Portland, and tickets for Moon Alice on October 23rd are available at alhambrapdx.com.
That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound.
We are joined in the studio today by Alex Gates, who is a member of the Portland State University Student Union. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit of background about this move by Portland State University to try to turn the security force into a full-fledged police force on campus.
There's been a new focus on especially sexual assault on campus across the U.S. As it's started to take kind of a center stage in campus human rights. And on the in response to that, the Board of Trustees at our school has been working to figure out different ways to address safety on campus. And they have done some things like locking buildings after hours and improving lighting. But one attempt that they're trying to do is to change our current security office into a fully sworn police force, which would include increase in general authority, as well as that they would all be carrying guns on campus. There's a lot of student pushback against that, and this has kind of been a plan that's been under development for a few years, kind of behind the scenes, and is just now starting to garner some public attention outside of the higher echelons of the administration on campus.
And I understand there's been a couple of forums at the Portland State University. Can you talk about what has gone on so far?
They are now starting to open up to public input from the community, so that they are making at least they're trying to show that they're making this a thing that's not just being mandated on campus. They have opened up. They've held one forum about 2 weeks ago, where both faculty and students were invited to attend. And in general, the administration, the people representing the administration on campus have been, you know, we're pretty okay with, you know, letting this go through. But almost every student that was called upon or asked to air input was opposed to this the proposal as it stands currently.
And PSU is a pretty urban campus and is integrated into the neighborhood. Don't the Portland police already have jurisdiction to go in if necessary?
They do. And Phil Zerzhin, which is the current, head of the campus security office, has presented his case that because Portland State is in the middle of campus or in the middle of the city, kind of its boundaries are kind of, there's lots of kind of a gerrymandered type situation with actual Portland State property. And so part of the argument is that the security office doesn't have authority to act in what would otherwise be considered part of Portland State. And so in those situations, they do call on the PPD. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you know of any of the history of the security there at PSU. I know we've talked to non-students who have been trespassed for what seems like no reason, and people who have been harassed by the Portland State security. Have you had any experience of that, or do you know of those type of instances with the Portland State Security Force?
I haven't personally had interaction like that with them, but I have heard a few accounts of them coming up to a few students that were on campus and were fine being there, and stopping them and treating them kind of negatively. I don't often know the details of that, but I have heard a few stories of that.
Well, and it's students of color that have voiced a lot of concern about arming the security there at Portland State.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the current, you know, general state of American policing and kind of the trend that's kind of been emerging over the last 20 years, it's not a jump at all to place this right as one additional instance of that playing out. You know, a lot of the perspective against guns is that, you know, when an officer has a gun and enters a situation in which his or her heart is, or, you know, it's a tense situation and they have a gun, that's the first item they reach for, even if they have mace, even if they have, you know, a baton or some other means of dealing with the situation. Like, there was a student about 3 years ago, I believe, Gil Collar, who was having a mental health crisis and was killed by a campus police officer. He was naked, unarmed, but the officer felt threatened. And while the officer had a taser, while the officer had a baton, while he had other options, he also had a gun. And that's what he reached for in that moment. And, you know, when that's your hammer, all of a sudden everything's a nail.
Where was that?
It was in Texas.
And at Portland State University, has there been an increase in crime or assaults that is the impetus for this call for armed police?
I don't know that there's actually been an increase in the rate. We have had, the campus has grown substantially over the last decade or so. And the campus security office hasn't increased its personnel to meet that. And so part of Zerzan's argument and the administration's argument is that, well, we need to accommodate our larger campus. Well, you know, most of us are completely okay with hiring on more security personnel. If that's what's needed, that's fine. But there's a difference between personnel and staffing and having people available to provide security and giving them extrajudicial capital punishment, you know.
How are sexual assaults dealt with on the PSU campus?
That is one of the issues that they are introducing the sworn police force to deal with. Currently, we contract with the Portland Police Department. We have a detective who is only what comes onto campus and deals with sexual assault cases primarily. The thing is, you know, sexual assault doesn't happen when a police officer is present. You know, direct intervention is uncommon by a law enforcement officer. It's more something that can be prevented through bystander training and things that actually address the instance versus after the fact. And the problem is, you know, so few, I think something like 5% of sexual assault cases are reported because of the traumatic process of reliving that and not really knowing how it's going to be dealt with, and often mishandling of the case and just kind of not really following up on it nearly as well as it should be.
And that would not change with the introduction of an armed police force.
Not really. I mean, you have police that are able to basically do the same thing that the detective is doing, but there's not really an increase in the administrations or any change in the way the administration deals with sexual assault cases, which I think is more important. In addition to preventative measures like training on bystander training and self-defense classes and all of those, and even you know, maybe a class on consent for incoming freshmen, because I know when I was growing up, I was never talked to about consent, and so you have a lot of, especially freshman sophomore years are the years where sexual assault most often happens, and so equipping everyone with knowledge and empowerment on the front end can do a lot to prevent that rash of sexual assault.
I know that there have been a few policies put in place, like in California with the Yes Means Yes law at University of California campuses, and at Harvard, this measure that is now gaining some controversy about sexual assault and consent. Are there any similar measures being proposed at PSU for education of the student body and ensuring that there is accountability and justice for survivors?
Yes, there is. There is one thing that is a mandatory online introduction to what is consent. However, it was something that I was able. I mean, I was. It's a mandatory thing that all students have to take. I took it. Effective as actually changing my ideas about the issue. It's on the computer. It's something I click through and read. It's not. There's not a level of actual engagement with another human being in the way that sexual assault is engagement with another human being, and I think it needs to be preempted in something much more personal than that. And I feel like that effort was much more just something to comply with the Title IX mandate from President Obama mandated that all campus universities should do something. I don't know exactly the details, but should be attempting to reduce sexual assault on campus. So it's like on paper a response to that, but as someone who had gone, who went through the, clicked through the training in 10 minutes, I don't remember anything from it.
And are there any other classes or trainings being offered by PSU in order to address this?
Currently, if they are, they're not being well well advertised, because I don't know of any.
A lot of times the Women's Resource Center ends up being a place of support for survivors of sexual assault there at Portland State University. Have they weighed in on this proposal to arm the security?
You know, it's interesting. They have. In fact, they wrote a very early letter of support. In fact, their letter of support about this proposal was the first blip on the radar that the student union and most of the students had that this was going on. I don't know the details of. I know that the task force that has been developing the proposal was working with the Women's Resource Center very closely, and so I think that's part of the reason they came out in support of this so early. But I don't know that. That support is representative necessarily of the non-administrative parts of the WRC, along with the one of the administrators that runs the Queer Resource Center on campus too. So officially, both of those resource centers have come out in support of the proposal, but I haven't heard supportive attitudes from any students.
What are students doing to mobilize around this issue?
Well, currently, SUSU, or the Portland State Student Union, we're working on a campaign to get the vote, which is slated to be held on December 11th. We're trying to get that postponed till late spring so that we can review the proposal more closely and attempt an alternate proposal that actually has student input.
And what are some of the ideas that people have for alternatives to arming the security or creating a campus police force?
Well, honestly, the idea of a campus police force is less, I think, less of an issue than the idea that they will be armed. And I know Chief Zerzan has stated explicitly that he absolutely supports if there are going to be police officers on campus, that they will be armed. And I think there's a leap between expanding police authority, which I think there are decent arguments to be made for that. But when you include regular access to a firearm immediately at your hip, that changes. I think fundamentally that changes the way police officers relate to the community that they will serve. And I think we've seen that play out continually. ProPublica actually just released a report of the FBI's report on police violence and homicides. And that showed that black males are actually targeted at a rate 21 times higher than white males. And so at a certain point, you know, when arming police doesn't actually have an effect on limiting sexual assault, but it does have an effect on this perceived and actual safety of people of color on campus. I think there's better alternatives to limiting sexual assault and actually creating a safer campus.
And has this issue at all pitted women against students of color?
Not yet. I other than, you know, again, other than the leadership of the WRC, I haven't heard all of the women in SUSU are take this perspective. And I think the reality is that if you look into the statistics, that arming police, it's you don't have to dig to find that it doesn't actually positively affect the rates of sexual assault. In fact, you know,
so it doesn't reduce the level of sexual assault to have armed police.
No. And in fact, there's I'd have to look up the reference, but police officers are actually accused of sexual misconduct at 2.7 times the rate of the general populace. So when that's the solution to sexual assault, there's a fundamental mismatch with that logic, I think.
Are you asking for community members to get involved in this campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've talked briefly. I don't know how much has come of this with some of the organizers that are holding the Ferguson solidarity actions up in North Portland, and see if they might would like to collaborate on this issue, as it is a directly related thing.
Well, and again, coming back to Portland State University being mm-hmm. an urban campus, a lot of people are on campus that aren't necessarily students. You know, most of the time, it's a public area, so it would definitely impact the community in that sense.
Right, and I think the fact is that the Board of Trustees have kind of. The administration structure of PSU recently changed. The Board of Trustees just took over in July, and they held an initial meeting where they almost went ahead and approved this proposal in September, on September 11th, actually. There was enough pushback to get it moved back to December, but you know, immediately after a major organizational change in the university, these tasks are being implemented, and there's a narrative that it fits into the kind of the neoliberal kind of corporatization of the university. It's like, you know, classically universities have been very, very democratic spaces in a lot of ways. But we're, I mean, even at Portland State, we're seeing that that's slowly eroding, or quickly eroding even now, that this is being done basically without community input.
Well, and that's been an issue at Portland State University over the past year. There was an issue with the teachers at Portland State University facing a contract that that almost led to a strike. And and we reported extensively on that. And at that time, it came out that there's a very kind of top-down governing structure with President Vim Vivel. Have you seen President Vim Vivel at the helm of this move to move the police or move the security towards an armed police force?
He definitely supports it currently. I don't know that he's been on the front lines of pushing this forward, but I've had conversations with him, and he currently supports this move, of course. He reports to the Board of Trustees, and they support this move. And yeah, no, there is a very top-down, non-democratic structure that's carried out there. In fact, some of the teachers that that fought for their wage increase, they recently, I think it was like 4 months ago, have lost those.
So if people want to find out more or get involved, what's the best way to do that?
Well, of course, the student union's website is psusu.org. You can look there, or our Facebook. That would be a starting point, I would say.
And it's PSU Student Union on Facebook?
Yes.
So if you look at psusu.org or PSU Student Union on Facebook. That's the Portland State University Student Union that's currently organizing a campaign to oppose the transfer of the Portland State University security guards into an armed police force on campus. I'm speaking with Alex Gates today, who is a part of the Portland State University Student Union. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio. A last-minute bill has been introduced in the Pennsylvania state legislature known as the Re-Victimization Relief Act. This bill, if passed, could subject anyone convicted of a personal crime to legal action if they speak publicly. Pennsylvania Representative Mike Vareb introduced the measure after political commentator, author, and Free Speech Radio News contributor Mumia Abu-Jamal delivered a commencement address at Vermont's Goddard College on October 6th. Prison Radio recorded the speech over the phone, and the audio was replayed to the graduating class of 23 seniors. In 1982, a jury convicted Abu-Jamal of first-degree murder for the 1981 shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. The trial drew significant criticism from legal experts due to numerous irregularities. Abu-Jamal spent 30 years on death row, including 10 after his death sentence was overturned. In 2011, he was transferred to the general population SCI Mahoney Prison, where he's currently serving a sentence of life without parole and consistently maintains his innocence. Mumia Abu-Jamal continues to advocate for prison and sentencing reform, and his audio commentaries on a wide variety of topics are heard on radio stations across the country and online, including here at KBOO. Noelle Hanrahan is director of Prison Radio and produces Mumia's work. She joins Nell Abram with Free Speech Radio News to discuss the Pennsylvania bill.
First, this bill is framed as one that's intended to protect victims of violent crimes. What's wrong with that?
Victims are being used as a tactic by the Fraternal Order of Police to silence voices that politicians and the Fraternal Order of Police don't want to be present in the public debate and dialogue on the criminal justice system.
Does the proposed law only apply to people who are incarcerated?
It also applies to people who have finished their incarceration but are still under correctional control. So it would apply to a wide range of people in the United States. I think we really have to frame it in a different way. This isn't, in fact, about the experience of people who are victims of violent crime. Many people in prison are already victims of violent crime. Those who are in prison who are innocent are victims of violent crime. People don't lose their constitutional rights when they go into prison. The greater import for free speech issues and First Amendment issues is the fact that we are a criminogenic nation. We are a culture that creates crime. We have the highest imprisonment population in the world, and the conditions of confinement affect everyone, regardless of prison walls. So healthcare in prison, the fact that we choose to spend money on prisons versus preschools, that we spend more per capita than any culture on earth, that is a defining thing for everyone. As journalists, as a journalist who records prisoners, we need those voices from inside. This is an attempt by politicians and the Fraternal Order of Police to warehouse those voices and keep them from the public debate. This is a crucial issue for our culture at this point. It's really a defining issue. We need to understand what the culture of incarceration is doing to the culture, and we can only do that with first-person voices from people inside.
When the bill was introduced, one Pennsylvania representative, Rosemary Brown, specifically inquired about how the law, if passed, could apply to anyone who facilitates communication between the person incarcerated and a public audience. Would this bill potentially affect producers like you and even media outlets who seek to balance news reports by including the voices of the huge U.S. population living behind bars?
This affects every single reporter and every single person who accepts a phone call and then plays that message back in public. People in prison do not lose their First Amendment rights. They don't lose many of their rights. They're still protected under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. These are very important things to defend, because once they're taken away from some of us, they are in fact taken away from all of us.
This bill would preemptively block free speech, assuming intent and effect. And the Supreme Court has already ruled on the collateral emotional effects of free speech when they upheld the rights of Westboro Baptist Church and its leader, Fred Phelps, to hold vicious homophobic protests outside military funerals. Could this measure pass constitutional muster?
Absolutely not. It's very likely that it will be defeated. But the cost to both our First Amendment rights during the process of its defeat will be extreme. This bill will pass the Pennsylvania State House and Senate. It will be signed into law by Governor Tom Corbett. And if they're successful in implementing it very quickly, a judge within Pennsylvania can issue an injunction and stop reporters from having access to inmates. So this could come quickly. We probably have to file a lawsuit preemptively to stop it from its implementation. Otherwise, we're looking at losing speech until we can get through the court system. And the Pennsylvania court system and the federal court system are, in fact, very anti-prisoner. It could take a long time, and we will lose a lot of ground.
Wednesday is a day of action about the proposed bill. Tell us what's happening in the state capitol.
Two busloads of people are going up to the Capitol. They're meeting with legislators on the floor of the Pennsylvania State and House, and they are making their points known that they are people who are very concerned about prisoners' First Amendment rights not being silenced. We've had hundreds and hundreds of calls all day yesterday and today into the State House to try and impress upon the legislatures that people really will come out for this. Right now, the Pennsylvania State and Senate and House are controlled by the Republicans, so it's very likely that this will pass if it reaches the floor. Today is the last day of our session in Pennsylvania, so it may not reach the floor if cooler heads prevail. That doesn't mean it's going away. It may be well brought back in the next session.
Noelle Hanrahan is director of Prison Radio, based in both San Francisco and Philadelphia. More information is online at prisonradio.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
And stay tuned. Next up is the Noontime Jamboree, and that is right after the noon news on KBOO Portland.
And now for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, October 20th, 2014. The World Health Organization has admitted to making serious mistakes in the West African Ebola epidemic. In a draft acquired by the Associated Press, the organization admitted that a slow response time and bureaucracy hindered prevention efforts. The document noted that many WHO officials in Africa were nominated for political reasons rather than for their expertise. There have also been problems with getting visas for aid workers and transferring aid money. Critics also fault higher-ups in the organization for taking too long to respond. It took 5 months for the organization to classify the outbreak as a health emergency. In that time, 1,000 people died. A number of wealthy individuals are helping fund Republicans in Senate races this fall. They're led by the infamous Koch brothers, who have spent $12.3 million on 8 Senate races in the last few weeks. Hedge fund CEO Bob Mercer also donated $2.5 million to the Koch brothers' super PAC, Freedom Partners Action Fund. Mercer's donated almost $7 million total to Senate races this election cycle. Top Democratic backers include former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who donated $350,000 to a Georgia super PAC. Democrats currently control the Senate. Republicans need to win 6 new seats to take it. Raising the minimum wage could save social service programs billions. This is according to a report released last week by the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. The report found that 1.7 million individuals would no longer require government aid if the federal minimum wage was raised to $10.10 an hour. This would